Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Discover More,
where we strive to discover more through intentional dialogues. My name is Benoit.
And my name is Aiden. This podcast will serve as a space to exchange ideas from the collective experience.
Good afternoon, everyone. We hope everyone had a relaxing weekend. Today's guest is Will Pham, a licensed social worker who has been accumulating clinical hours to become a psychotherapist. When he was a child, he was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, or known as PR. It is a rare genetic condition that involves a breakdown and loss of cells in the retina. In short, his vision regressed every year and eventually leads to his blindness. This condition sparked his passion in helping and educating others in other similarly stigmatized fields. He comes with a deep wealth of knowledge and experience in mental health in the field of counseling and therapy. In this episode, we cover a wide range of topics, from the important role of family dynamics in one's development and one's achievement in life, the danger of social media, and the relationship between optimality and perfectionism. Please enjoy our discussion this week with Will Pham, and thank you for tuning in. Good afternoon, everyone. On this week, we have my coworker, Will Pham. He is another coworker of mine from my nonprofit agency that we talked about, and he comes with an array of experiences and certifications. He has a master's degree in social work. He is a licensed social worker, and he's currently in pursuit of his practices in clinical therapy. So we are very excited to have him on board for this show, and I would like to turn the mic over to him for him to introduce who he is, his background, and his journey so far. So Will, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. So of course, as Benoit had discussed, most of my background is in social work. The way I got into social work is actually through my own experiences of being blind. So growing up, I grew up with a retinal degenerative condition called retinitis pigmentosa. So I was diagnosed with that when I was in first grade. And so I think with having that condition, it wasn't really something that ever had seriously impacted me until I had reached high school, because it is a degenerative condition, your vision is progressively getting worse. So when I had hit high school, it was like a time when I remember walking into a class and like looking at a textbook and realizing that I couldn't see any of the text on the page anymore. So that first year was an extremely difficult year for me. And through that process, I was connected to, through my school's guidance counselor, a lot of different social workers who had really assisted me in kind of giving me the appropriate academic supports to kind of get through high school. And through that experience, like, I didn't necessarily know that I wanted to go into social work, but I definitely wanted to kind of provide that feeling of support to someone else in some capacity. So I kind of toyed around with a lot of different career paths, but it definitely did end up going back into social work, which is what I did for my undergrad and grad experience.
And you talked about that your blindness was not really considered as defective or affected your daily life until you came to high school. So when you first heard about the diagnosis, about this rare condition that you have, how were you able to internalize that? Because unlike a lot of people who were born into blindness, right? Sure. They didn't know what to give up, and they didn't know the vibrantness of the world because they were born into it. In the contrary, you were born just like everyone else, and you were able to witness the sun, the senses, the sensory, and all that. And where your condition was regressive, so you're going to progressively lose that. How did you internalize that, and how are you able to accept that condition in a way that's considered as productive?
Yeah, for sure. I think growing up as a kid, before I had experienced more significant vision loss, honestly, it didn't really affect me that much. I just was like the kid in the classroom who had really thick glasses and had to sit in the front. But aside from that, it didn't really have that much of an impact on me. I remember like growing up and there would be different things that my family would do, like out of a concern of like wondering where my like vision was. So I have these like very specific memories of like driving in during like long car rides with my family, and my like mom asking me to read street signs on the highway and seeing like how close we had to be able to actually for me to fully read the signs. So I think when I was younger, it didn't really have a significant impact on me. I just knew that I was like the kid who had bad vision. Later on, when I was in high school and kind of walking to that class and kind of experiencing the like shock of like realizing how much vision I'd actually lost like over the like summer. I think that for me was definitely a much more difficult thing. You know, I think when you're in a position where so much of your life has been visually learning, it definitely turns things around when you realize that that can't be your main mode of kind of like building comprehension. So yeah, I think in high school was really, really difficult because I think that for myself, it was like such like a huge point of like insecurity. And like, I didn't really want people to necessarily know that I had any type of like visual condition. And so for me, I think like the early years of high school slash later in high school was like an extremely difficult time and just like managing it. At the time, I was going to a hospital that had a retina specialist in Boston. I think it was actually at like Harvard Hospital that I'd gone to, and they had just like run like a huge array of tests. And yeah, I remember coming back from that hospital experience and just being told that there would be a day that I would lose all of my vision. That was like a pretty big shock. Yeah, it was just a really difficult thing to deal with. And at the time, again, you know, I really didn't feel like my family kind of fully understood that experience. Everyone was just like very concerned. But that to me kind of just like made things much harder.
So many of our guests that we have on, of course, everyone comes with different type of family dynamics. Sure. And different families serve as different pillars and different supportive roles in their lives. And it sounds like your family didn't necessarily quite understand the specific challenge and the condition they were going through, except the fact that they knew you were going to become blind eventually, right?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So with that gap of understanding between your family members and yourself, how were you able to, or what did you do to help manage and navigate that gap of understanding between yourself, between your challenges, and what your family thought you were going through?
Yeah, I think it's hard, right? Because I think most people don't grow up with any exposure or experience with people who are blind. I think that was what was really difficult for my own family, where like my mom didn't really understand it because she essentially just didn't really know what to do. You know, it's like when a kid is like losing vision and the end result will be him having no vision. It's like as like a parent, you're super worried, but you don't necessarily know what supports can we provide, especially if you just have had no understanding or exposure to like what can be helpful. But I grew up in like a really kind of like interesting family. So I grew up in like a single parent household. And as a kid, I don't think I had fully recognized how hard my mom worked until I got older. But like my mom worked extraordinarily hard. And I definitely grew up in a setting where like achievement was like a pretty big thing in terms of that being pushed, particularly academically. And so you're kind of put as a blind kid, you're kind of put in this like weird position, right? Where when you don't have the adequate supports, but you still come from a family that really pushes achievement and the importance of education. And so I was kind of like put in a very difficult position where like I really wasn't kind of sure how to approach it. I just knew I just had to work really hard. And so I think during that time period, like luckily I had a really good group of friends that had really supported me through my high school years. And through that time period, I just had to do things that were just like a little bit different than the like other students. Like just like the process of reading took me much longer. I think at that point in high school, I didn't really have many like non-visual skills that were built up yet. So I was just kind of manually reading, and that process was very slow. But what that allowed me to do was kind of like interestingly enough, kind of build just patience, right? Where like if X thing takes a student 30 minutes to read, it might take me double the amount of time. So like every piece of work that I'm doing takes me double the amount of time. So it's just like building patience and like kind of understanding that these are my like circumstances and kind of pushing through it and just, you know, taking the amount of time that I need to get something done. And that's just kind of been how things have gone.
Did you find that you were retaining the information more, like putting in that deliberate time, like to the example you said, if you're spending twice the amount of time learning the information or reading it, would you find it easier to actually retain the information, or did it become more comprehensive in the learning that you were doing? I guess in comparison to the way you were learning, you mentioned you were a visual learner to begin with, and then did those new strategies kind of help your learning, and especially like compared to the peers, just what was that school experience kind of like?
I'm not really exactly sure if because of the amount of time that I was spending extra in terms of just going through that physical process of like reading, like assisted my comprehension. I felt like my comprehension was pretty decent through high school. Everything just kind of took longer and it was just a little bit more cumbersome. Could I actually ask you guys a question?
Yeah.
So one of the things I'm actually curious about is how much do you guys know about the climber Alex Honnold?
Definitely not much. Haven't heard of
not Alex much.
Honnold. Okay. Alex Honnold is a pretty famous climber. I think he was most famously known recently. He had done the film Free Solo, and he's most famously known for doing free solo climbs, essentially, like climbing without any gear, right? And one of the things I thought was like really interesting through that process is like he talks about the idea of being perfect and kind of like his own family dynamics have led him to be in that place. Because essentially with free solo climbing, essentially what happens is a climber is practicing on a route for months and months and months, right? So they are literally practicing each one of the holds. And then when they feel like they're kind of psychologically and physically ready, they will take off all the equipment and then climb, you know, a huge rock face. In this case, he climbed El Capitan, which is a huge, huge, huge rock face that took several hours for him to climb without any gear. And so it's when you're going through that process, that's kind of the epitome of perfection, right? Because if you literally kind of slip or are not doing a certain movement correctly, it just ends up in death. And so one of the things I think was really interesting was he had kind of talked about the idea that for himself, you know, feeling perfect, even if it was for a brief moment, was something that, you know, was like extremely gratifying. And he had come from a family where his mom didn't really show him too much emotional responsiveness. In the film, he talked about two things that were really interesting. Like her two kind of classic lines were almost doesn't count and good enough isn't. And so one of the things I'm also curious about is like for you guys in terms of like your family dynamics, do you feel like you guys grew up in a family that was like very big on achievement? And did you guys grow up in families that that weren't very traditionally emotionally responsive? And also how that kind of affected you guys?
Yeah, for sure. I think early on, achievement was always kind of like a cornerstone of, I guess, our upbringing. Obviously, I think with the importance of academics and learning, you know, we're definitely blessed to come into like a pretty, I guess, intelligent family. So knowing that intelligence as well as opportunity, we ended up going to one of the better public schools in Pennsylvania. I mean, just the nature of the area that we live, I think, has a lot of the better schooling. So presented with that opportunity of both inherent intelligence as well as opportunity of situation, achievement was always very much important, both in more so academics, not as much sports. I think this definitely evolved as we got older and older. I think my parents started to recognize the trying more so, like trying your best more so than a specific number on an exam or a specific letter grade. But I think that was kind of a learning process both for my parents as well as for myself, because when you're in middle school or even high school, obviously grades are such a important part of getting into the right college, kind of like setting up your whole future ahead of you. But as I guess more and more adversities come, whether that's harder classes or just life gets in the way, there's extraneous circumstances that might change the specific number. One example that we talked about, Andre, last week is how running a specific time can tell numerous different stories. Same deal with an exam. Say 95 can tell so many different stories considering the context of how much time did you have to study? What stresses were you navigating in that specific exam time frame? You know, so I think as we were getting older, that kind of shifted away from an achievement model and more so just putting your full self and actually really trying your best, which is something that's kind of a lesson that we both continue to learn.
I think that's also really healthy too, the idea of like the, in particular in terms of like academics, the number grade doesn't matter as much as just the idea that you're trying your best. I didn't necessarily grow up in that family. The kind of family I grew up in was more like the number grade mattered more if you tried your best or not. And the kind of family I grew up in was very much like if the number grade wasn't there, then that was inherently showing that you didn't try your best. What were your experiences with that, Benoit?
So, Will, it's similar to your because I'm also an Asian American descendant. Of course, I received my citizenship and naturalization. So I didn't grow up in the Western education system until high school years. But my mom was definitely the stereotypical Asian tiger mom. She put the education and the grades and the whole academic achievements on a pedestal. But I think she was less inclined towards using metrics as the education system as to measure or my outcome of my success. More of she wanted to use my effort as the metrics, which I really appreciated. But I think that's another thing because she was such a high achiever, and the generational gap, I think, in terms of understanding comes from the fact that our previous generation, they hold themselves onto such a standard because of their circumstances, like the point that Aiden was alluding to. And my mom definitely went through extremely more strenuous and circumstantial life than that I have. Well, I was born into everything. I was born into a very prestigious or privileged socioeconomic background versus my mom. She had to go through so much more hardships, such as losing my grandfather at a very young age. And my grandma, back in the days, were in Asia where women weren't expected to work. So my grandmother was equipped with adequate skills to survive in the Asian culture, especially. It's like super patriarchal, where men are perceived and considered as a power holder in every aspect in society in Asia. So with those generation gap, but I think my mom understood that I was given into my innate abilities, the certain amount of intelligence I was born into because of my parents' high academic and professional achievements. But yeah, I wasn't always the tryhard up until I think college. I was able to breathe through and survive high school because of the intellectual hardware I was given. But a lot of times I didn't really find a lot of subjects and classes interesting. And so it definitely took me until college to, I guess, for me to excel, for me to fully tap into my potential. But I think with that being said, I have a question for you, Will, is that you talked about, I think, family dynamics. It comes down to either your family are supportive or they're not supportive, or they're trying to be supportive, but they fall short. And I think as fellow Asian American like yourself and like myself, that you are born into this expected realm of achieving certain outcome, right? Despite your circumstances, despite your condition. And of course, I think that your mom was trying to be understanding because they don't really know what to do with your condition because it's a first. And I think in the Asian culture, our culture puts so much more emphasis on a lot of stigmas. And a lot of times, I think that it's difficult for them to navigate between, or for them to internalize between their expectations and the reality, because a lot of times you can expect something to happen, but there's so much hardships and obstacles that are on the way that you have to take considering into for the outcome. And my mom, I think, was able to do that to a certain degree. But a lot of times my mom was hard on me because she knew I didn't try my hardest. And that's why a lot of times she was disappointed in the outcomes or the grades that I produced, not because of the certain letter grades or the percentage, but because of the lack of effort that was attached to the outcome of my grades. So in this sense, do you think, or what did you do to help navigate between, because you said that your condition enabled you to be very, very hyper patient with everything that you do. And did that patience also apply to your own family dynamics? Because when you didn't get that A or didn't get the 96% that your mom was expecting, how did you able to navigate that versus, like, maybe she was disappointed in your outcome, or were you disappointed in the outcome, or how are you able to manage all that intertwined, interconnected expectations between yourself and your mom?
Yeah, I think it's had a lot of different effects in my own life. I think one of it is definitely like developing some kind of intensive, like, perfectionistic tendencies. So for me, it's like when you grow up in a family where achievement is like a really important thing and you may not meet that, you're kind of constantly striving for that, right? Like in every situation, striving for, high achievement or striving for perfection, right? My family wasn't very like emotional in the sense of like growing up, like virtually no one in my family ever said the words, I love you. At any point in my own life, like, I can't remember a time when my mom had ever said to me or my sister that she was proud of something that we did. And so I think with those dynamics too, it's like, as someone growing up in that kind of context, you're kind of constantly striving to gain approval. I think, like, for me, that has definitely manifested in developing certain tendencies of trying to constantly reach perfection, which I think it's difficult, right? Because when you do put in significant efforts and you kind of like reach what you perceive to be perfection, it's a phenomenal feeling, but I feel like it's also like a dangerous slope. Both of you guys, I'm sure you guys know about obsessive compulsive disorder, right?
Yep.
So obsessive compulsive disorder, what is really interesting about a condition like that is that the obsessive piece is like a thought, right? It's like you can be obsessing about anything, right? And so in this condition, the second piece is the compulsion, which is the action, right? So it's like, I may have a thought about, you know, about needing to like wash my hands, and that may be tied to thoughts about like cleanliness, etc. And then the act of washing your hands actually kind of reduces your anxiety, right? So it's kind of almost reinforcing the obsession. So every time you're obsessed with something, you engage in that compulsion, it reduces your anxiety minimally, but then it kind of strengthens in your head the idea that you need to keep doing this, right? And so I feel like having perfectionistic tendencies, depending on the degree, it's like almost a cousin to OCD, right? Because it's like you are working so hard to try to reach perfection, and then when you perceive that you do, there's all these awesome things that happen from it, right? You get approval from like either work or school. There's like some type of like praise involved in that in terms of like reaching some type of like standard. And then unfortunately what that does is like that, similar to OCD, it reinforces the fact that you have to keep doing that. And I think what can be difficult out of that is when you get to a point of, for every single thing, not having the ability to kind of fully assess like the times when you need to be putting in max effort, and the times when it isn't necessarily optimal or necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. The relationship with perfection is definitely, I think, super widespread, especially with how prevalent social media is becoming, just because, you know, everyone says the people's timeline is their perfect life in a lot of ways. They're not posting about their struggles. They're generally posting the best things or their idea or image of perfection. So I think that almost, to what you said, it is kind of a slope, but this almost creates like a funnel of it, because it's not just an inherent perfection that might be generated from upbringing or personal experiences, but it's also being exacerbated by the widespread perfectionism a lot of times. Like Ben and I just kind of talked through my perfectionist tendencies when it comes to posting on Instagram.
Sure.
Because I personally want to make sure that like the content I'm producing or the things I'm writing, I believe in and I really am proud of, I guess, right? Like I want to put my full self into what I'm writing.
Sure.
But then there's also that delicate balance of what you said of reaching that perfectionism or just putting stuff out to keep the ball rolling, right? So I guess to embrace the process rather than to try and get to that end perfection point in a lot of ways. Like, what did you call it? The perfection point and the optimal point. Perfectional point often is a lot higher than the optimal point, but that spread of work and energy that you have to get from optimal to perfection is generally not sustainable or even realistic.
I think one of the things that you said that was really interesting is like kind of talking about your own experiences with that within social media. And I think just the kind of culture we live in with social media kind of heightens that, you know, the idea that we live in a world now where like people's lives are so much more visible through social media than virtually any other time period, right? And it's like when you have that level of exposure at all times, I feel like it also pushes, it propels people to kind of have a certain image, not only online, but just like offline also, and kind of to be able to maintain that. So it kind of almost like reinforces the idea that, hey, not only do I have to have, a perfect image online or an image that displays me in the most positive capacity possible, but, you know, in real life to be able to kind of do that too. Yeah, I have like very mixed feelings about social media. When I was in grad school, there was a situation where, because at the time, all of us were kind of in different field placements, working within like different like different specific social populations. And this one student came into a class one day and had talked about how he had been working with a student who had pretty significant issues with depression. And the student had gone on to Facebook and had seen a like fellow classmate, during the previous weekend, just having like the best time of their lives, right? And I think what's so interesting about that is like, you know, being older, we were able to recognize that social media, it's like the highlights of someone's life, right? And this kid, because of just like how young they were, and because of like the lack of like just like pure life exposure and experience, like wasn't able to necessarily recognize that in the same way. And that's, I think that can be like a very difficult thing with the impact of social media when you're a kid. You know, also too, it made me think about this other situation where a friend of mine in college had told me some story about how she had roommates who would go out every Friday and would go out and like party and like dress up, and they would take photos together, and on social media it would look like they were just having like the best time ever, right? But consistently they'd come back like every Friday, every Saturday night, and would just have the worst time. But like no one would ever know that, right? Because like online, like the image is just like they're such good friends, they're having the like best time. And so I think it can be a real challenge.
Absolutely. And I think that's so prevalent. Have both of you guys seen that like meme that's going around of the Toronto Maple Leafs kid that's taking a selfie with his girlfriend?
No.
So it's like a 6-1. He's there with his girlfriend. They're like sitting in the nosebleeds and his team's down 6-1. Clearly like a huge hockey fan, has like the hat on, the jersey, and his girlfriend like goes up for a selfie. So you just see him crack this little smile. She takes the picture. As soon as she like goes back to her phone, he just looks like he's like absolutely miserable, completely straight face, like
really
having the worst time. But it really just, I think, represents this exact situation of like,
sure,
yeah, the picture that she sent and probably posted on our picture, oh, having a great time at the hockey game. In reality, this kid's fuming because his team's losing by 7-6 goals. And,
sure,
you know, she's just there for the photos and stuff like that. But it's the perception externally is often misaligned with what's currently, I guess, the internal perception or the internal experience.
For sure.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that's the perfect, I guess, analogy to compare like the optimality versus perfectionist view, because I know that Will, that you definitely have a lot of tendencies and exhibit a lot of perfectionist behaviors. And Aiden, you talked about you definitely exhibit the similar tendencies for social media production, because I think all of us who are considered as high achievers, we embody and we live through a lot of high standards, and we put ourselves to match a certain outcome because we believe we have the ability to. And that's like the inner world is like the hockey kid, where his inner world is his miserable because his team is down 6 goals. And then the outer world is the selfie that his girlfriend that took with her boyfriend, where you're perceived as happy but in reality you're not. And I think the optimality point or the optimal point is objectively the standard that you're generally producing a very optimal outcome. Your outcome and your work production is generally optimal, right? That's like the optimal point. But then your inner reality is you're always striving for that perfectionist point, and you're exerting so much that marginal difference between the optimal point and the perfectionist point. And in reality, you could have spent that and reallocated that marginal effort and energy and talents towards something else because you hit that outer reality of optimal point, but you're trying so hard to go for your inner reality and your inner perception of what you consider as optimal, which is actually the perfectionist point, right? So I think the optimality and perfectionist point definitely comes into your mental thoughts, because it's all mental. And it's like you talked about a person that's diagnosed with OCD condition, it's hard for him and her to let go of their obsessive compulsive control, because in their minds they have to hit what they consider as optimal or what they consider as perfect, which is the obsessive component. And then the compulsory component is that they cannot help it, which is what you talked about. So I think I want to use that to circle back into your life about, you talked about where you had to exert twice as much effort on everything, right? And of course that may not necessarily help you to retain more information, because you're just simply exerting more effort to, I guess, achieve the certain standard of what you consider as optimal. And do you think that your mom or your family was able to see that you're, in your own way, you're trying as hard as you can, and you may not always hit what they consider or what your mom considers as the optimal point? And if that was the case, how did you able to manage that? And I'd love to hear more about how you were able to eventually come to acceptance of your condition, because I think to strive and to be better at something, you have to, or the saying is, you know, like the AA meetings, acceptance is the first step to recovery. Of course, you're not recovering from anything.
Sure.
Yeah, but yeah. I think a lot of times people definitely, are not achieving their optimal or their maximum capacities because they're not accepting who they are. And of course, your condition is part of who you are as a person. And if you didn't accept your condition, then of course you wouldn't be here right now with your school trainings, your degrees, and your certifications. So I just love to talk about your insight and your process of making what helps you to navigate your internal standards versus your mom's standards, and how you're able to fully come to acceptance of your condition as a whole.
When I think about that, one of the things I think about is I think in coming to the place I have now, so much of it when I was younger was essentially just unfortunately kind of just doing my own thing and trying my best to kind of not give in to my mom's expectations, I guess, because it's difficult, right? Like in high school, as like a kid, you're dealing with blindness, but as every teenager, you're also just dealing with like general teen angst. So like, I just remember like a lot of time in high school was just like spent like in my room and like not engaging with my like other family members. So I feel like in terms of my level of efforts, like my mom would know that I would like stay up super late to do work. But she didn't really maybe fully understand the extent of like how much effort was being put in, like whether it was like the like late nights or like the efforts are put in like actually during school time. But yeah, again, I think if in looking back at it, there's no way that I could have, but I really wish that there was some way that I could have been more compassionate for myself and more understanding of myself to kind of accept the blindness piece of it. Because I think losing vision in high school is such a difficult thing, right? Because it's like a time period where you are the most self-conscious about yourself. So you're kind of going through this time where you're super self-conscious about yourself and like the way that people are perceiving you, but you don't necessarily understand that everyone's feeling that way. So it makes you feel like you're kind of alone in the space. I think like as a blind kid, it's particularly difficult, right? Because like, I think traditionally in society, blindness is seen as a like weakness, right? So it's like, whether it's blindness or anything else, everyone kind of wants to kind of not display any signs of like weakness. And so for me, it was like, just like trying my best to like hide it and not be obvious about it, which made my life so much more difficult, right? Because like during times when I connected with teachers to kind of get accommodations for certain things, there's this kind of weird thing that was going on where I was like, I don't want you to be obvious about this, but I want the help, right? So it kind of puts teachers in like a very uncomfortable position. I am so grateful of the fact that they just kind of like went with it. But I think, you know, high school is very difficult in that sense. And yeah, there's definitely a lot of like kind of like strange things that I would kind of do to like hide the fact that I had this condition, because like during high school and college at that point, I still wasn't using a cane yet. And that was very dangerous for me in the sense that my condition is particularly exacerbated when I'm in like low light level situations. So if I'm switching light levels, like if I'm outside, it's like super sunny and I walk into like a very dim room with my condition, my pupils take significantly longer to adjust. And so when I'm walking into a dim space, I essentially have zero vision, right? When that happens, you're doing kind of different things, like you're fumbling with things, pretending to do something to just give yourself time for your pupils to like adjust so that you don't seem weird. But yeah, so there's just like a lot of things that had happened, you know, throughout high school and college. And even through college, I was connected to different services through different like nonprofits and like social work agencies that definitely like helped me out tremendously through that process. But I still wasn't necessarily comfortable enough in myself to be okay with, you know, kind of identifying as someone who's blind. Because for so much of my life, I went and just said that I have like a visual impairment or I'm like legally blind, right? And I remember this one particular instance where I was in high school where this orientation and mobility instructor, someone who like comes and like teaches a potential student about cane travel and like using a cane, he came to me and it was a very weird interaction when I was in high school, but it was like, I think my junior or senior year of high school. He came to me, we had like a sit down and he asked me, hey, his first question to me was, what do you think of when you think of a blind person? And at the time, I literally had no idea what he meant. So I just like kind of sat there in silence. I was like, I have no idea what this guy wants me to say. And so then he was like, do you think of someone in a suit, like a very professional person? And I also didn't really know what he said. But yeah, so at the time, he was just like really trying to make me challenge the idea of what perceptions society has for like a blind person and what they can do versus the average idea of like what being blind means. And at the time, he really wanted me to take up his like services and like learn how to use AKN and kind of go through that process. And I remember going home and I was talking to my like mom about it, and she was like, absolutely not. My mom did not want me to like use AKN. And her mentality was, if I use AKN, it'll be super obvious and that will affect people's perceptions of me and in a very negative capacity, and also affect perceptions for our family, right? And so I didn't use AKN throughout high school, throughout college. There were times where I was put into very dangerous situations because of that. And during my senior year of college, I was put into a situation where because I transferred schools, some of the credits that I was that I previously had received through my first year before I transferred didn't transfer over. And so I had to take more classes during my last year. And so that resulted in more finances that my family wasn't ready for. And so during the time I applied to a scholarship through Connecticut's National Federation of the Blind. And honestly, for me, it was just like, hey, this is like a chance for me to get some money to pay off, some of that school debt. And that's kind of pretty much all I thought about it. Like, you just had to, check off the fact that you were, at least legally blind, which what that means is essentially there are kind of various levels of blindness. I think some people have the idea of like either you have like perfect vision or you have zero vision. Of course, there's like a lot of gray areas, right? Like people wear glasses and people have like, if you're 90% blind, you have 10% vision. Like, what does that mean, right? But to be legally blind essentially means that, right? You have like 90% blind, you have 10% vision. And the specifics of it are having 20/200 vision, which is if an average person can see something from 200 feet, the legally blind person would have to see it from 20 feet, right? But with that being said, I applied for the scholarship, won the scholarship, had to go to a conference to accept it, right? And so in winning that scholarship, there was someone who had contacted me and was just like giving me details about the conference. And at the time, he was 1 year older than me. And he had asked me, hey, what are you doing right now? Like, this is like your last year of like college. Like, what are your plans afterward? And at that time, I was like super burnt out of school. I had no idea what I wanted to do. My family was like, hey, like you should go to grad school. But I was like, I don't know if I could do more schooling. And so I just said, I have no idea. And he was like, well, he was at the time 1 year older than me. His path was, he was also thinking about grad school, but he said, hey, I'm also blind. I ended up going into this program called the Louisiana Center for the Blind. And so I was like, oh, like, what's that like? And he said, you're there for an entire year and you spend 8 hours every single day blindfolded, regardless of like what level of vision you have. And you go through like extremely rigorous training. And so at that point, it was like, this seems like very intense. I don't know if this is going to be for me, but I was like, hey, I would love to meet up with you at this conference and have some more discussion about it. So we go to the conference. I meet up with him. We have some more talks about it. He's just like saying like the most insane things to me. Like, he said, hey, like the program, one of the things there's like different components. One of the components is cane travel. So you learn how to use a cane for the first time, regardless if you've used one before or not. And so one of the things you do at the end is called a drop route. So staff within the training center drive you to a location in the town. You have no idea where you are. They drop you off. You can't ask any questions of anyone on the street and you have to make your way back. So I was like, oh my God, like this is like so crazy. Like, how is it possible that someone can do this? And then he was like saying all these other things. Like, there's a cooking component because they really try to teach you like all the possible skills you will ever need to kind of be fully independent. And he said, the last thing you have to do for this cooking class is you have to cook a 3-course meal for 40 people from scratch by yourself. And I was like, that's insane. Like growing up for me, like my mom was so scared of me burning down the house as like a blind person that she like never let me cook. And so I was like, I have no idea how to cook. Like, how can I possibly cook a 3-course meal from scratch for 40 people, So I think it was just like a very interesting idea at that point. And so I was like, hey, I literally have no idea about what I'm going to do after college. So why don't I just do this? I remember like winning the scholarship, going home and talking to my mom about it. And she was like, not for it. She was like, the idea of being blindfolded for an entire year, like that's like, that means that Will's in like prime, like danger zone for like an entire year. Right. And like, my mom's already like a huge worrier. So she was just not for it. But at that time it was like, really like, I was very much in a zone of like, I can't fully take in what my mom has to say. And like, this feels right for me. I just have to do it. So like, kind of like against my mom's wishes, I just went for it and did it. So what's really nice is that when you engage in a program like this, you can reach out to different government agencies and they can provide funding for you. So I went to this completely free, which really worked out for me because my family definitely did not have the financial means to pay for something like this. But yeah, so I remember I had like a conversation with the program's director, and yeah, I remember just saying to her on the phone, like, I'm really excited to be scared for an entire year. I remember the first day out of the airport. So I like flew down to Louisiana. It's like in this extremely small town in Ruston, Louisiana. I flew down. There was another student who was coming from Connecticut. So we were both coming at the same time. So someone was picking us up. And so one of the staff members comes out. And initially I was like so confused because like this person had zero vision. So they're walking around this airport, getting super lost. And I was like trying to help this person out, and like the staff member wasn't helping them out at all. And I was like, why isn't this person doing anything, right? This person has no idea where they're going. Like the staff member is not giving them very much direction, and they're really struggling right now. Like why aren't they getting any help? And through the process of the training, I really understood why there was that mentality. So this particular training center is very different than virtually any other training center across the city, across the like, states. There is only three centers like this. They're specifically called structured discovery training centers. So they have a very specific kind of like training modality. Most training centers across the United States, the staff are most of the time people who are sighted. And the expectations are super low in terms of like what they push students to do. At this particular training center, most of your instructors are all blind. So there are a couple of main classes that you take as like a student. There is cane travel, which you learn how to use a cane and kind of learn all the travel skills. There's a braille class, so you learn braille either for the first time or you improve on your existing braille skills. There's a technology class where you learn how to use a computer completely non-visually. There's a cooking class slash home ec class. And then there's also a class that's a shop class, which isn't necessarily like a life skill, but it's really more of a class to build confidence, because a lot of students who come in living lives of being a blind child have had very low confidence, very like low self-esteem. And so in this shop class, they kind of take you step by step, and then you end up using like all these crazy power tools with like no adjustments, right? And you have to build a like project by the end of it. So like that's like a huge confidence builder in terms of like, you know, using all this crazy, power tool equipment, and you know, at the same time being completely safe, because throughout all these classes you have to be blindfolded. So I think it was just like a very interesting experience.
So Will, we really appreciate you sharing about your very over-encompassing and very inclusive experience with your training center, and it sounded like that training center served as a platform for you to get exposed, and for it was like a very accelerated learning experience for you. But I do want to jump back and talk about the judgment piece, right? Because I think the reason why stigmas and misconceptions and misinformation are very toxic because of they're derived and are rooted in the judgment piece.
Sure.
A lot of times, like you said, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that blindness is on a spectrum. Because when I first was exposed to you on a professional setting, because that person never worked with a fellow person with a blindness before, mm-hmm. especially you're at a position where many of us cannot achieve even though we don't have that condition. So, but what I realized is that a blindness is a spectrum, and not everyone's 100% blind and 100% visually capable, right? There's like a in between, and when you embarked on your journey to that training center, you're on the 90% blindness, 10% visual split, and you were considered legally blind, but you still had some of visual ability left. Mm-hmm. But none of those would have happened, and none of these interconnected experiences would have happened for you to pick up cane traveling, cooking, and all the other if you didn't and find a way to overcome your judgment piece. Because the fact that when your person who was 1 year older who gave you this advice or who told you about this program that's out there, you wouldn't even have considered the fact that if you were still in denial with your identity, because I think everyone is born with multiple identities, right? Which is what we call in our field intersectional identities, where Will, you're a person with blindness, you're a male, you're an Asian, you're a son, and everyone comes with different identities. But I think for you specifically, your identity of blindness is such a predominant and significant factor of who you are, because it affects your everyday life, literally. So how did you first able to manage and cope and overcome that judgment piece? Because the fact that your mom, of course, she cared about the whole face value. She really cared about the whole social perception, which is what stigma is, right? Stigma is literally misinformation and misjudgment from the societal level into a particular topic and field. And so how did you manage that? Like, first of all, how did you manage or convince yourself that you're like, hey, this is inevitable. I'm just going to accept I'm blind because that's part of who I am.
Sure.
And how did you combat that along where your mom was adding on to her judgment? Because she didn't want you to perceive it as this person with weakness, right? The stigma.
For sure.
So I'm very interested about your ability to juggle that judgment. And we will talk more about what kind of judgment you face and your ability to dismiss and or not take any of these judgments seriously post-training.
Yeah, I think when I first entered the training center, I was definitely still not on the full acceptance piece of it. I definitely had not fully like drank the Kool-Aid of the training center yet, because some of their ideas, I think from an outside perspective, can be considered to be somewhat radical. But I think part of the thing was, it was really helpful to kind of be around other kind of blind role models, I think, for sure. Because like all of your instructors were all blind, they were all super successful. You kind of see them on like a daily basis, navigating like super normal lives. And as, you know, growing up in a smaller town, like maybe being the only blind person in my town, going off to school. And actually, the first school I went to was Union College. And I remember someone in the support services office literally said to me that I was the first blind person to ever attend that school.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think so much of it for me was just like not having enough exposure to other blind people. Particularly people who were successful, because my mentality for so long was like, this is something that's really going to bring me down. Losing vision is going to lead to a path where I will not be employable. I will be at home and I'll probably be living with my parents for like the rest of my life. Like that's like my like internal like negative self-talk, right? But yeah, I think through the process of, you know, working with these instructors, like that had major impact. Because I remember very specifically during those cane trouble classes, like we'd be spending 2 hours like walking around. And when you're doing that, not only are you engaged in the class instruction, but you also develop like a very close one-on-one relationship with your instructor. And my instructor, you know, definitely had assisted me greatly in that process, because I think what was so great was that you see this person who's like the fully formed person, who's like the prime example of like what it means to be someone who like accepts blindness and is like killing it. And you think about yourself where you're so far away, and it's difficult to kind of like comprehend how you can get there. But he told me these like very honest stories. Like myself, he had the same exact condition I had, where he was progressively losing vision when he entered, because he actually went to the training center himself. And when he entered the training center, he was pretty apprehensive about using a cane for the first time, but he went through the program, did very well in cane travel. And when he went home after the year-long program, he actually didn't even use his cane because he was too embarrassed about it, you know? And he was too embarrassed about it. He was too embarrassed to, like, you know, walk around his, like, hometown with a cane and be perceived as, like, a blind person. So he just didn't use it. And, you know, like, a summer later, he was asked to come back and work for the training center during one of their summer programs. And he came back and he felt so ashamed because the training center had put so much work into kind of, changing his ideas about what it means to be a blind person. So there was like even a lot of internal conflict for him and kind of processing that and like understanding that it's like okay to like walk around and be like a confident blind person. I think just through those experiences of like having these like very, you know, real conversations with my key instructor, having conversations with the other students who are at various levels of like blindness was like extremely important for me to kind of come to terms with it. I remember, you know, during the Thanksgiving break when I went home for the first time, I was really scared. I remember having these conversations with my key instructor during our classes, like telling him like, when I go home, like, I don't know how I'm going to like deal with this, because like I can't fathom the idea of people seeing me with a cane. Like for forever, people have not seen me with a cane. They're going to see me with a cane. They're going to ask me all these questions, because like people may have not known that I had, you know, that I'm blind. And so I was just like really scared. I remember I went home. I was hanging out with like friends who saw me for the first time with a cane, and we went to a restaurant. And I remember when I walked in that restaurant, I was literally trembling. I was like shaking because I was so scared of like running into like someone else who's going to ask me questions. Because at that time, like my close friends knew, and my close friends knew that I was going to the training center and that I would be using a cane. But no one else knew. So I was just so scared about it. And I think it's also that exposure experience of like having the courage to put yourself in situations where you feel uncomfortable in this kind of way, to come out of it and realize that it's totally okay. And I think, and I'm definitely not at a point where I'm like 100%, you know, and like comfortable, and I'll always be comfortable, because I think it's like, I think forever will be like a source of like insecurity, but I think it's like something that I'm always working on. And I think there was significant progress because recently I went to my 10-year high school reunion. And so I remember talking to my friend, and I remember saying like, I don't think I can go, because like people will be asking me so many questions. I cannot do this. And he was like very encouraging. He was like, you know what? If you don't feel comfortable going, you totally don't have to go. But then we ended up going. And I remember like walking into this place where it's like all these people from high school that I haven't talked to in like a long time. And like there were certainly questions. But then at the end of it, I also realized like, you know, people 10 years later are actually just like super chill. And like it wasn't actually that big of a deal, right? Mm-hmm. And like moments like that I thought were so impactful, because you build up this thought in your head that something's going to be so bad, right? And then you have the experience and then you have insight. When I was in grad school, there was this discussion about the idea about experience before insight, right? The idea like sometimes you have to have an experience directly to have the insight from it. It's difficult to have it be the other way around, right? So
I love that you said that. There's a saying that I really like is wisdom is the synthesis of knowledge and experience, sure, right? So you need to have both of them interchangeably. Like you can read a book, you can gain knowledge through a book. You can have experiences to gain some sort of knowledge, but wisdom's actually the combination of the two, which sounds like the experience you had, you know, combining both the technical skills as well as the experience of the training center itself kind of came together for the insight, as you said, and wisdom kind of all overarching.
Yeah, I appreciate both of you stating that, because of course, before we talk about the idea where experience breeds perspective, and in this case, insight. So it definitely sounds like you went through an overall extremely satisfying and life-changing, I would argue, experience. So it's funny because I think the training center is such a different experience from many settings, because we use the idea of teaching someone how to fish versus giving them a fish, right? But I think the mission statement of that whole training center is built on that idea of they really want to foster independence and to empowerment, right? Because they're putting you in these seemingly impossible and extremely, extremely difficult situations where you're doing many things for the first time, and you're being instructed by someone who's considered by society as a weakness, which is blind instructors. But I think it was empowering because you, like you talked about, you're put into a setting with many positive role models, and they tell you firsthand, literally, that everything is possible, and then they're living a normally, quote unquote, like everyone else, even with this condition. Because I do want to talk more about your specialization and your concentration in mental health and the whole therapy aspect. And of course, you're not a clinical therapist as of yet, and you're building your hours, and that's your next transition in your professional life. But I think the reason why therapy is very difficult, and there's so much stigma attached to therapy, because of the awareness aspect, right? Because a lot of times, self-awareness, I think, is one of the most difficult things for people to internalize and to accept. Because to be self-aware, you have to be aware and fully accepting of your flaws and your conditions and whatever that may you have. In your case, for you to have that acceptance, for you to be truly self-aware is very difficult, or it was difficult, because of you consider blindness as such like a predominant and scary part of your identity. And if you are to be scared and be fearful of certain things, you cannot be aware of it. Well, you might be aware of it, but you might not be able to acceptances of it. And of course, with therapy, that space provides a lot of outlet and positive way for people to become not only self-aware, but become self-acceptance of their flaws. And that's how they progress and better. So, Will, when I first met you, I realized I think one of your greatest virtues that you had was that you're extremely self-aware, and you knew your strengths and your weaknesses. And I think that only came afterwards, because like I said, you must have gone through so much different journeys and so many different processes to be able to fully come to acceptance of who you are as a person that includes all your components and all your aspects of your life. And so how has that been working for you? And because you talked about when you came home from the training center, you were terrified, and then Aiden and I talk about the idea of do not live your life predicated on the fear of other people's opinions. And of course, everything is mental, and your fear and your fear for judgments become amplified and magnified in your head. But in reality, the experience versus insight aftermath, you realize the insight actually wasn't that bad at all, and it was all in your head. People don't really care as much. But how are you continuing using that? And do you think that all of this experience helped you to become extremely comfortable with the judgments? Because I think you're extremely honest and you're very comfortable with vulnerability, and the fact that you're willing to come onto this show and to share about such a vulnerable experience of who you are, because it was very difficult. Of course, even now hearing the things you went through, I have all my five senses, and I think if you put me in a whole traveling aspect and for me to be able to create and work on my mental mapping aspect, where you put me in any city, I don't think I'll be able to find my way back in an adequate manner versus you did. So yeah, I like to talk about your judgment piece and how you're able to use that skill set you picked up from the training center on a day-to-day and maybe on a professional level.
Sure. On a day-to-day, I think that, you know, like I said earlier, the majority of people don't really have a lot of exposure to blind people. It's like, if you walked up to any average person who said, hey, in your lifetime, have you ever talked to a blind person? Most people would probably say no, right? And so I think that there are a lot of misconceptions because of that, of like what it means. You know, I think even one of the classic things that people say is like, hey, you know, when you lose your vision, all of your other senses are enhanced. And that is definitely very bogus, but I think the easiest way to think about it is like, where does that come from? Because it's like, if someone loses their hearing, does their vision get enhanced? And it's like, most people don't have that perception, but for whatever reason, they have the opposite perception, right? And it's like, I think it has a lot to do with the kind of images that we see of blind people, especially like portrayed in like media, right? It's like the blind person in a lot of different media is portrayed to be like mystical in some capacity. I think that there was like a Star Wars film where there's like a blind dude and like he kind of like, he was blind, but like he used the like force to be able to like guide him. So like, that's also like kind of like, you know, a mystical component of it. But yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of part of the exposure piece. Like, so little people are exposed to blind people, so they kind of don't really know what to kind of expect or, you know, what it really means. I mean, I think on a day-to-day basis, like, so many times I've been in like situations of like getting into an Uber or like, you know, just like walking around where people are like, what's that? And they'll be pointing to my cane and they have no idea what it is. Like, I'll literally be walking around, I'll be using it. They have no idea what it is. And that's because I also use a slightly different type of cane. When you're in the training center, they give you what's called a NFB straight cane. NFB stands for National Federation of the Blind. But it is a very different cane than what you would normally see. It doesn't fold. And that has a couple different reasons. One of which is like, it doesn't fold because it forces you to not hide it. And secondly, it doesn't fold because when a cane folds and you have grooves in a cane, it minimizes like the sensitivity of the like cane to be able to feel different textures. So it's a more optimal cane and it's physically longer. So my cane goes up to my nose if it's like standing straight. Most other canes are much shorter. A longer cane allows you to have more reaction time. So it allows you to like walk faster, right? Because if you have a very short cane and you're walking, it forces you to walk very slow in case you like bump into something, right? So I think just in the fact that people see this cane and have no idea what it is, I think that speaks volumes, right? Because like, it'd be super weird if someone with a wheelchair came into a building and three people were like, what is that, right? Yeah. Like, that would be super weird, right? Mm-hmm. But it's literally something that happens to me all the time. Like 25% of the time I'm outside, something is asked of me or something is said. And many times people actually don't even believe that I'm blind. Like, I'll be walking through Philly and it's very common for me to hear, you're not blind. And then that to be followed by some type of like exploitive, like against me. It's like, it's very weird. I think it's just like people typically don't see like a blind person kind of like walking quickly and like confidently. So it's like, people have a certain idea of like what it means. Like, I'm not wearing sunglasses. So it's like, you know, just like a different image that I think people are kind of used to. And I think with that judgment piece, it's hard because the day you catch me on, like how stressed out I am that day, it kind of depends on how I deal with it. So I think it's the assumption that if you're blind, that means that you need help. Even if someone, like the second someone sees the cane, that's like an immediate indicator to them of like, this person needs help, even if I know nothing about them. And there are times when I deal with that in providing the education piece of it and having like a talk with them if I have time about it. Or if I'm in a rush, I'll just say like, hey, I'm totally okay. And then I'll just, you know, cross the street and keep moving. So it kind of depends on the day. Also depends on how people ask me, because like some people are like super rude about it. But yeah, I think with the like, judgment piece, it's hard, right? Because in a sense, it's like a microaggression. And so when you're just walking through Philly on like a day-to-day basis and this is like constantly happening to you, it gets very annoying. But then you also kind of like turn it off in the sense of like you just like ignore it. Like someone says something, you just ignore it. And so I feel like I'm kind of more on that spectrum now where like I ignore it and I don't really process it super heavily. So I think like that's how I've kind of managed it, because like in every situation with how much it happens, like, you know, you're not gonna have the time every like situation to like sit down and have a conversation to like educate someone, right? So
yeah, I just wanted to quickly define the concept and the idea of microaggressions for some listeners out there who aren't aware. So micro, of course, is micro, which is small, and then aggression is aggression. But microaggression, for example, is that people are exhibiting aggressive behavior in a very implicit and subtle way. So a common example that I tell people about is for a person who's not Caucasian, right? A lot of times they could be Latinos, Hispanic, Middle Eastern, Brown, African Americans, or Asian descendants. And then they will ask you, hey, where are you from? And you tell them, oh, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then they will follow with the question of, no, where you're really from, which what the question they're implying is, what's your ethnicity? Because you don't look like one of us. You're obviously not a Caucasian, so where are you from? So that's like an example for microaggressions. I just wanted to quickly define that for some people. But
oh, quick thing too. To tail back a little bit and kind of adding a second layer to your question earlier about the judgment piece, I was just thinking about this. I think also too, I've also just gotten to a place of like when weird stuff happens, kind of putting myself in their shoes and like understanding, hey, this person is making this comment because they just haven't had the like exposure or et cetera, and kind of taking like having like perspective taking in that sense and understanding where it comes from. Also to the training center itself, it kind of forces you to be comfortable with yourself, and it forces you to get to a point of being okay with, you know, of course, a blind person. So I think that has also been tremendously helpful too, and just like walking around on like a daily basis and hearing comments. So yeah.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Discover More. We release a new episode every Monday on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and would really appreciate if you have subscribed and shared this with your friends.
We hope you enjoyed this episode, and join us next week in the journey of discovering more through intentional dialogues.